We're ready to begin Isaiah chapter 54 with the first verse. We have just finished the great prophecy given in Isaiah 53 about the Messiah. And this 54th chapter actually is a sort of a continuation of that thought in that it gives some great promises here to the church or to the future state of Israel. He begins in the first verse by saying, "Sing, O barren, thou that didst not bear." Now the word "O barren" here probably applies to the church. And it is a figure which shows a female who was not able to bear children. And many times we have the church or God's people referred to in that manner, referred to as a woman or as a wife or as a mother, and then one who has lost her children or one who is not able to have children, and consequently she is in a state of being barren. And this is and was considered to be something that was not a blessed or a preferable state to be in. It was a result of God's people having disobeyed Him and having found disfavor with Him, and consequently then they were not allowed then to bear or to multiply. So here he says, in referring to his people and ultimately to the church, he says, "Sing, O barren, thou that didst not bear." Now this is referring to God's people when they were in the state of disfavor, referring to them while they were in the Babylonian captivity. And there have been other periods in which the church or in which God's people could be said to be in a barren state. But now he tells them to sing. "Sing, O barren, thou that didst not bear. Break forth into singing and cry aloud, thou that didst not travail with child." So he's referring to the fact that they were in a state of non-productivity. They were not allowed to bear. They were not allowed to reproduce. They did not grow. They diminished in number rather than to flourish and to grow and to be as God would want them to be. But now he says they're going to have occasion to sing. They're going to have occasion to break forth into singing and to cry aloud, "Thou that didst not travail with child." And the reason for this is, "For more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife, saith the Lord." Now this last statement, to understand it, we have to determine who are the desolate and who is represented by the married wife. "More are the children of the desolate." Now the desolate here is the church or Israel, and it is referred to as being desolate because it did not bear, it did not bring forth fruit like it should. "More are the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife." And the married wife would be the other nations, those round about the church who seem to be flourishing so, who seem to be not in a barren or non-productive state, but who seem to be going very much according to their expectations. That's the married wife. God's people are the desolate. But he says there's coming a time in which there are going to be more children belonging to the desolate than there are children belonging to the married wife. That is, God's people are going to thrive and they're going to prosper. They're going to increase and be successful to such an extent that they're going to seem to be in a better state or a more prosperous state than the married wife and the children that she might have. That is, the children of the other nations. And as we look at this prophecy and seeing that it has greater and lesser fulfillments, we've seen this happen several times since this prophecy was given. God's people did go back to Jerusalem. They did rebuild the temple in the city and the state of Jerusalem, or Judea, and they were prosperous in that sense. And then we have seen this prosperity seem to wane and fade away and then come back. And then when the church was established, it was such a small and desolate group, and it did seem to be barren. And then it was allowed to prosper, and it did prosper, and it has flourished. And it has outlasted all of the other nations that were in existence at the time that it was established, so that it really has had children that were more abundant and more than the children of the married wife, that is, the children of the other nations, because the other nations have ceased to exist, and they've had to be replaced by new and different nations, whereas the church has remained the same throughout all this time. So as he tells them then about this this promise of being greatly blessed and being made to proliferate, he enlarges on the promise in verse 2 by saying, "Enlarge the place of thy tent, and let them stretch forth the curtains of thy habitations." Now, he's just saying, just make your habitation larger. Make your tent larger. Make provisions for more people to inhabit your area. In the case of Jerusalem and Judea, they were to get ready for an ultimate time of prosperity, and they would need to have more space and more territory than they needed at the time they left the captivity, or at the time they were in the captivity. In the case of the church, we see that there is no limit to the space that can be occupied by the church. For the church is not limited to the boundaries of a nation, but the church is made to inhabit the entire world. It can invade the borders of any nation and inhabit that territory. And so consequently, all nations then are subjected to being a part of the territory of the church. And so this statement, to enlarge the place of thy tent and let them stretch forth the curtains of thine habitations, and the word curtains here means canopy of a tent, really means get ready to need more territory for your peoples to occupy. And he further elaborates on that by saying, "Spare not, lengthen thy cords, and strengthen thy stakes." All having to do with the parts of a tent and parts of the houses that they lived in back then, which were made of tents. And this is just stating that you're going to have a larger space, more territory to occupy than you have had in the past. Verse 3, "For thou shalt break forth on the right hand and on the left, and thy seed shall inherit the Gentiles, and make the desolate cities to be inhabited." Now, "thy seed shall inherit the Gentiles" is a prophecy about the Gentiles then obeying the gospel and becoming a part of the people of God and joining ranks with God's people, which is exactly what has happened in the Christian age. This is a prophecy about it, and we're now living during and through that time. The statement is very plain here about "thy seed shall inherit the Gentiles." That is, the Gentiles would come in and be a part of thy seed. And he said, "We'll make the desolate cities to be inhabited." That is, those cities that could have been the cities of God that were not the cities of God, they shall be inhabited. And truly in the world today, there are many, many places that still yet can be inhabited by the people of God. Cities that can now be called desolate. Any area that's not occupied by the people of God could be called a desolate city. And so it can be inhabited. And we see that there have been great areas in which God's people have occupied and inhabited and established a true church. And that still yet can be fulfilled even more. So beginning in verse 4, he says, "Fear not, for thou shalt not be ashamed, neither be thou confounded, for thou shalt not be put to shame. For thou shalt forget the shame of thy youth, and shalt not remember the reproach of thy widowhood any more." Now, he's just simply saying here in this verse that God is going to protect his people. They're not going to be made ashamed or made to regret that they are God's people and that they are following His law and that they are doing His will. They'll not be made to regret or to be ashamed of that. They're not going to be confused or confounded into thinking, well, they chose the wrong way, because God is going to protect them. He's going to guide them, and there'll be no reason to fear then since they have chosen the way of God. And he goes on in that verse and says, "For thou shalt forget the shame of thy youth." Now, their youth here was whenever they were in a childhood state, and it's really referring to their bondage, to the time when they were in bondage in Babylon. That's the time of their youth. And there'll come to the time, he says, in which you're not going to be ashamed of that. Rather, you're going to forget the shame of that. And the times are going to be so much better, and that's going to be put behind you, that you won't even remember that being a shameful state in which you were in bondage. And he says, and shalt not remember the reproach of thy widowhood anymore. Here again, this word widowhood is referring to their Babylonian captivity, in which they were without a husband and seemingly without a god, and having to then be a barren woman. Verse 5, for thy maker is thine husband. Now this is a verse again given to comfort and reassure and to instruct them as to what their true relationship is with God. Thy maker is thine husband. Now this is really a comforting verse to the people of God. Thy maker, that is the one who created you, the one who has all the power over you, he is your husband. He is the one then that has chosen you to be his wife. He is the one who will be instrumental in bringing you to bear children and to be fruitful and multiply. He is the one that will be involved in that. Thy maker is thine husband. And as he goes on and further describes the maker in this verse, he says the Lord of hosts is his name. Now the Lord of hosts is the name given to Jehovah. And it means he is the Lord of all of the universe, the Lord of all of the planets, the Lord of hosts. And thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. Again, another description given to Jehovah as being the Redeemer, the one who's going to save them, the one who's going to buy them out of their captivity and their bondage. And we really, they're ultimately referred to the price paid by Christ when he bought them out of their captivity. He says, thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. Again, now another phrase describing him, the God of the whole earth shall he be called. The God of the whole earth shall he be called. And in order to really understand this, we need to think about the fact that back during this time of Isaiah, and even before that each nation was thought of as having its own private individual god, because the nations were practicing idolatry, and one idol was as good as another, so each nation adopted their own idol. Well, this idea of God being the God of more than one nation was kind of a foreign idea. He was the God of Israel, and other nations had other gods. And he was the one true God, though. He was the one a living God, while all the others were false gods and idolatrous gods. He was the one living God. But now in this phrase, he is referred to as the God of the whole earth shall he be called. And that was a kind of a new and foreign and strange idea to even the people of God, and especially was it a strange idea to those who were not the people of God. But we know this to be true, and it's very muchly fulfilled during the time of the gospel. And this is definitely a reference to the gospel time in which he is the God of the whole earth. That is, he is the God that would cross the boundaries of all of the nations. And he would have people, he would have followers in every nation throughout the whole earth, and anybody, anywhere on the earth could have him then for a God. The God of the whole earth shall he be called. And we know that this certainly is a true statement, for he is the one God, that is a living God, that is a powerful God. He is the one God that did create the earth and all the people that are on the earth, and who controls the affairs of this planet. Now, verse 6. For the Lord hath called thee as a woman forsaken and grieved in spirit and a wife of youth when thou wast refused, saith thy God. Now here again he's further describing the relationship of the children of Israel to God. And he's talking about the time of their Babylonian captivity. The Lord hath called thee as a woman forsaken and grieved in spirit. Now she had been taken as a wife, according to this figure. He says, a wife of youth. She'd been taken as a young wife, and then because of her misdeed, she had been forsaken and grieved in spirit. She was forsaken, that is, allowed to be carried into captivity and to be separated from God and to become in a state that is a barren state, a state of dishonor. And because of this, she was grieved in spirit. Now, while she was in this state, that is, a young wife that had been forsaken and made to grieve in spirit, while she was in this state, he says, the Lord hath called thee. The Lord hath called thee as a woman forsaken and grieved in spirit, a wife of youth, when thou wast refused, saith thy God. And this word when has been translated also to mean although. Although thou wast refused, saith thy God. Here she was in a shameful state. She had been forsaken. She had been grieved in spirit and left as a young wife, no longer fitted for her husband. But now the Lord came back and called her, although she had been refused. And we're able to understand this now as we just think of Israel being in this state of captivity and God deciding now to free them from the captivity, being as though a husband has come back to the forsaken wife and now ready to forgive her. So in verse 7 he further describes this. He says, for a small moment have I forsaken thee, but with great mercies will I gather thee. Now their time of captivity is referred to as a small moment. And we know that it was an approximate 70-year period. But in the eyes of God, and when compared to the great span of time that this universe occupies, it's only a small moment. For a small moment have I forsaken thee. While in that period of captivity, it seemed that God had forsaken them. It seemed that they did not have a God. It seems that God had completely turned against them. And he calls this a small moment. Now it seemed like a great time to these people. For some of them it was an entire lifetime. Many of them who went to Babylon, I'm sure, died and never were able to know any other life outside of that period of captivity. But he calls it a small moment. And then he says, but with great mercies will I gather thee. That is, the mercies that he extends to his people are so much more abundant and so much greater than the trials of this life that they're referred to as great when compared to this time of forsaking. With great mercies will I gather thee. And truly it is the mercies of God, that is, God being willing to overlook our shortcomings and to forgive us and to no longer hold these things against us. These mercies of God are so great, and it's only because of them that any of us have a chance of ever being reconciled to God. So he says, but with great mercy will I gather thee. And of course, if we would think of 70 years as being a great time, and God calls that a small moment, then certainly what he calls great, we would really think of as being great. It'd be greater than anything we can imagine when we really stop and try to fathom the greatness of his mercies. And I believe that this not only is a statement about God's people when they were in the Babylonian captivity, but it's also a statement that has greater and lesser fulfillments throughout the period and history of the church, and even in our age today. There are times today in which we have to be forsaken by God because of our disobedience, our ignorance, our poor decisions about things as we live in this life. But yet, when we do repent, when we do capitulate, as it were, and give over to God and allow our stubborn wills to be guided by Him, then it's with great mercies that He will gather us. That is, we're no longer forsaken, but we are gathered back. We've been allowed to come back into the fold. And our our trials and tribulations and our times of being in this figurative state of being forsaken are no doubt not nearly as great as it was with these people of Israel when they were taken into captivity in Babylon. But nevertheless, it is a greater and lesser fulfillment of the same idea. In verse 8, "In a little wrath I hid my face from thee for a moment." Now here again is another description of this. "In a little wrath I hid my face from thee for a moment." This verse has many and various interpretations. Some of them interpret this phrase, little wrath, as being overflowing wrath or great wrath. But I believe we can get the lesson from it by just staying with the translation as we have it here. "In a little wrath I hid my face from thee for a moment." Now here again, this captivity of 70 years is referred to as God having hidden his face from them for a moment. And he calls it a little wrath. That is, he was angry. He was disappointed with his people. He did display this by allowing them to be completely uprooted from their homeland and taken away into a foreign country, and there being slaves of another government for 70 years. And so this is called in a little wrath. And he said, "I hid my face from thee." That is, he was ashamed of them, and he turned from them, and he allowed them to endure the consequences of their actions. And this happens to us even today. When we turn from God, when we let our lives so stray from God, then we're going to find that he will hide his face from us for a moment. That as we turn around and expect to lean upon and be succored by God, and God may not be there for a brief time because of our disobedience. Of course, we don't know exactly what this small amount of time is, this moment is. It can vary from one occasion to another, I'm sure, but with the Babylonian captivity, it was 70 years. And so what if it is a 5-year period in our lives, or a 10-year period, or a 12-month period, or whatever this may be, God will regard it as a small moment, or as a moment, but it may seem to be a much longer period to us. Now, the counterpart of that is, "But with everlasting kindness will I have mercy on thee, saith the Lord thy Redeemer." That is, when the time comes for redemption, when the time comes to be released from this captivity. Now, ours will never be like theirs. We'll never be completely, as a church, taken away into captivity like they were. But as individuals, we're going to have greater and lesser times of this trial and temptation. But then when the time is over, when we have turned to God and the time has come for him to free us from this tribulation, whatever it may be, he says, "With everlasting kindness will I have mercy on thee, saith the Lord thy Redeemer." So here he calls it a little wrath that he held for a moment, but the time of redemption is referred to as an everlasting kindness while I have mercy on thee. Now in verse 9, still referring to this, "For this is as the waters of Noah unto me. For as I have sworn that the waters of Noah should no more go over the earth, so have I sworn that I would not be wroth with thee nor rebuke thee." Now this is the account found in Genesis 8, verses 21 and 22, in which God promised that he would not again destroy the earth by water. Let's read that. Genesis 8, 21, 22. "And the Lord smelled a sweet savor, and the Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground any more for man's sake, for the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, neither will I again smite any more every living thing as I have done. While the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease." So there's the promise then that he would not do the earth anymore like he did at the time of the flood. So he says that this captivity of his people in Babylon is going to be like it was as the waters of Noah unto me. And just as he had sworn that he would no longer have the waters of Noah go over the earth like they did, so have I sworn that I would not be wroth with thee nor rebuke thee. So he's not going to do this anymore. Never again will the church be completely taken into total captivity as it was during this period of the Babylonian captivity. Now, that's a promise that we can think of today and look upon with great trust. Just as we know that there's never been another flood since the time of Noah like that flood was, then we'll know that there'll never be another time of captivity of God's people like the Babylonian captivity was. Now, there have been smaller floods, and there also will be smaller captivities, but never a total calamity as it was in the time of Noah or in the time of the Babylonian captivity. And this is enlightening to us as we think about the history of the church. We know that there was a great falling away of the church. We know that there was a time in which the church seemed to be practically non-existent during the Dark Ages. However, from this scripture and other teachings of the Bible, we have reason to believe that the church was not in a total state of apostasy, but that there were some remnants of the church that did remain faithful and that did continue to serve God throughout all that time. And the same is true in the future from the teaching of this ninth verse. Verse 10, "For the mountains shall depart, and the hills be removed, but my kindness shall not depart from thee, neither shall the covenant of my peace be removed, saith the Lord that hath mercy on thee." Now this is just a further teaching of this promise here. He says, "The mountains shall depart, and the hills be removed, but my kindness shall not depart from thee." That is, the mountains that you see are going to leave, and the hills are going to be moved before my kindness shall depart from thee. Now that's just how lasting His covenant is with His people. We see the mountains, you know. We go to Colorado and places and see those mountains and just see that it just be impossible for those mountains to depart, to be moved. Certainly not by us or by any force that we know of. But He says the time is going to come when those mountains will be moved and those hills will be removed before my kindness will depart from thee. And He says, "My kindness shall not depart from thee. Neither shall the covenant of my peace be removed, saith the Lord that has mercy on thee." Now the covenant of my peace is the covenant of His promised peace. He has promised us peace. Peace with our God. Peace with ourselves. Peace with our environment and situation. In that we are the people of God. We are stoic. We are not disturbed by the things that cause others to be tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine. We have peace and we have stability. That's what His covenant is all about. His covenant promises us that we can have peace. And so here it's called the covenant of my peace. "Neither shall the covenant of my peace be removed, saith the Lord that hath mercy on thee." So this is just a verse that's reinforcing the fact that God is not going to go back on His covenant. He's not going to go back on His promise. He is simply saying that it's going to remain and be very, very durable, more durable than the mountains and the hills that you see. Now, beginning in verse 11, he continues to give future, that is a promise of future stability and glory. "O thou afflicted, tossed with tempest, and not comforted, behold, I will lay thy stones with fair colors, and lay thy foundations with sapphires." Now here he's addressing his people. His people that have been in captivity. And as a result of their captivity, they have these phrases applied to them. Afflicted, tossed with tempest, and not comforted. And he's telling these people that he is going to give them a stable,